Diver well.
Topside.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, dive left surface.
Roger that. Tell me when you're on the bottom, Gary.
These days, if you want to get to France, or even to the Isle of Wight for that matter, you have to take a boat. But 10,000 or so years ago, it was a completely different picture. You could quite simply walk there. But then the ice sheet covering the northernmost parts of the nascent European superstate began to melt, submerging this prehistoric landscape beneath fathoms of cold, salty, and today, it has to be said, fairly cloudy water. And the landscape was hidden, largely forgotten, and certainly misunderstood.
It was terra incognita. It was a white space on a map, if such a map ever existed.
You could walk from Scotland to the Netherlands, or from Kent to Denmark quite easily.
I don't think that it's hyperbole to suggest that this is probably the most extensive and best preserved prehistoric landscape in Europe and possibly the world.
Over the next half hour, we're going to be following in the footsteps of our European ancestors and meeting the PhD student who's rediscovered not just a bridge at the bottom of the sea, more a country.
I was seeing a landscape which nobody had laid eye on for about 9,000 years. It was completely unknown, it's been lost in time, buried away, and nobody has really ever seen that landscape since the last people who walked on it.
Yeah, that was just made bottom.
Understood. What's the conditions like down there?
Not bad.
Ground swell?
Meter visibility.
Roger.
Quite clear. If we just follow the line here,
okay,
it should take us to some archaeological sites. Evidence of human occupation on the land when it was dry. Just along here.
Our story begins 15 metres beneath the surface of the Solent, between Lymington and the Isle of Wight.
I'm right behind you.
If you look here, Richard, you can see an old tree stump.
My underwater guide is Gary Momba, director of the Hampshire and Wight Maritime Archaeology Trust. He's showing me an underwater cliff that cuts through the course of an ancient river.
This is the land surface here, the peat and the wood. As you drop down, underneath, at this particular point, down vertically, you're going back in time. And this section here represents sediment laid on top of sediment on top of sediment before it was covered by this land surface with the oak trees.
The site was found accidentally and taken with other occasional discoveries in the shallow coastal waters of northwestern Europe reinforced the idea that sea levels were once much lower. But how much lower, what the pre-flood landscape looked like, and the extent of it were all open to conjecture. The problem, according to Professor Vince Gaffney, chair in landscape archaeology at Birmingham University, was that without any evidence to the contrary, we swallowed what the textbooks told us.
It has been difficult to simply get the concept across, even in academic terms. When I was a student, I was effectively taught that it was a land bridge, an area which you'd simply walked across to get to somewhere. You never stopped or looked around, apparently, if you read the literature.
And in the absence of any evidence, we imagined a bridge in a very traditional and narrow sense as a thin strip of land joining us to continental Europe, and on which no one would dream of settling.
Absolutely. You had a beginning point, Europe, and an end point, which was Britain. And there was nothing in between, despite the fact that by the Mesolithic period, we're talking about an area of about 20,000 square kilometres.
That we now know it was such a vast area is down in part to an enterprising research student at Birmingham University. Simon Fitch was young enough not to have been indoctrinated in the Landbridge School of Thought.
Well, it all started, I suppose, in my master's training when I was sitting in a remedial lecture learning about the Stone Age. And when it got to Mesolithic, it was very, very quick and brief flash-in-the-pan moment. But they were just saying, well, we've got a good record here in Britain, we've got a good record over in Europe. But the bit in between, yes, we know it existed, but there's nothing there. We can't get any data. We can't find anything. So, you know, it's pretty much a lost cause. And, of course, I didn't know any better, so I sat there thinking and thinking, well, I come from a geology background. I know there's a lot of oil and gas industry data and a lot of work survey out there. So there must be something we can find which will tell us what fits in between. So I then went looking for the data. So it was kind of odd, but it was really my ignorance which sent me in the right direction.
Fitch's first stop was to look at the sea depth or bathymetric data to create the sort of landscape you might get if it were possible to pull a giant bath plug on the seabed and drain away all the water.
Now, the problem with that topography is that in the intervening 8,000 or so years, there's been a lot of erosion and deposition, and areas which have lost and preserved land surfaces have had that material dumped and buried on top of areas which would be interested on. So obviously the whole landscape, the whole ballpark has changed. I mean, in some places the North Sea can be buried up to 30 metres, down the land surface can be buried by 30 metres or so of material. And even in the nearer shore areas, it can be anywhere between 30 centimetres and a metre deep. This can fill in quite a lot of things. Some of the things we've seen, some of the river channels we've seen, can actually be buried to quite a thickness of material just by recent sedimentation processes. So what we're seeing now is actually a product of modern processes, not the actual land surface on which the archaeology is actually preserved.
Fitch and his colleagues needed something to see through this thick blanket of sediment.
If we just move over here, about 10 foot, just a few metres.
The dive site in the Solent offers a tantalising glimpse of what might lie beneath. Here, the ebb and flow of the tide has washed away the covering material to reveal a rudimentary oven, as described to me underwater by marine archaeologist Gary Momba.
These arrangements of burnt flints here, they're the fill for an old hearth that was cut. I see there, that's a burnt clay, a clay nodule that's been burnt bright red. And you can see a bit clearer now.
So how did this work? Describe how this worked to me.
Well, there was a cutting running down here into the underlying deposit along the top here. They cut a hole and then they filled it with these flints, burnt flints. So it was a pit and they heated up a load of flints in fires nearby. When they were white hot, they would have picked them up and put them all in this pit. When the pit was full of white hot flint, it formed an oven. Then here it was covered with, the times were covered with sediment. You could put fish or meat or whatever in the oven to cook slowly. It was a Stone Age arga.
It's unlikely to be the only evidence of human occupation hidden beneath the waves. But without an accurate map, no one knew where else to look. The breakthrough came back in Birmingham, where Simon Fitch and his supervisor, Dr. Ken Thompson, hit on the idea of trawling through seismic data in the archives of a company which had surveyed the area for oil and gas deposits.
The head there, Hugh Edwards, very kindly, sympathetically let us in and took time to see us. And I think he thought we were a bit of a bunch of weirdos and probably quite right. And we went through the data and really chose the area we thought, based on our assumptions, was the best area. And then we went home with clutching our disc because the top of the data really wasn't of any interest to them. It had no commercial use. It's the byproduct, really. And went home with that one night.
So I sat down one evening, opened a bottle of wine and got the laptop out, and I was surprised how quickly we could get some reasonable images out. And emailed Simon and Vince and told them we were in business.
And I remember answering an email on Sunday morning from him, saying, you know, I sat down last night with a bottle of wine and stroking the cat on the sofa, just plugging away at the numbers, and you probably ought to see this. I then clicked down to the JPEG image attached to the bottom. And, of course, I saw the beautiful image, a landscape which was just like clear as any satellite image on Earth, it was astounding. There were rivers, coastlines, lakes, everything just bursting out of the seams. It was fantastic. amazing.
This is a kind of digital exploration, if you like. It's as thrilling as being Livingston in the jungle.
Exactly. It's as close as you'll ever get to being there, and it's kind of a virtual way of being in that world. It's a fantastic way of just putting yourself in that landscape and seeing a diverse environment, which was postulated but never known.
And this was your eureka moment. This was all based on a hunch that there was more out there than this thin, traditional notion of a bridge.
That's it. I never believed in my wildest dreams it would be as good as it is.
Oh, I'll be honest, I was quite bowled over. To see, almost immediately, a river the size of the Rhine, along which people had walked 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, but which had disappeared completely from all records, was truly amazing. You've got to compare that with, frankly, exploring other planets. It is as surprising as that. We are sending out space probes to do this sort of thing on Mars and the Moon that we are beginning to achieve on underneath the North Sea. It was that dramatic.
And that must have been a tremendous thrill.
Absolutely. And the moment that we saw this sort of data, we began to realise what we could do with the Southern North Sea. It wasn't just a case of, that's an interesting thing, a river. Once you've got that feature isolated, you can start thinking about creating a landscape. Once you've got a landscape, you can start thinking about the people and the animals and the plants which lived on it. Once you start doing that, you populate it. Once you start populating it, you begin to produce predictive models of where people lived. Once you produce predictive models of where people lived, you can go out and find evidence to prove whether you're right or wrong.
Back on the surface, on the deck of White Spirit, with a little bit of flint, Gary, that we've brought from the bottom.
Looking at material like this is how we identified the site in the first place. You can see these strong fractures here. This is white. It's been burnt and it's turned the whole thing white. It was a nice translucent colour, sort of a dark colour, almost see-through, these flints. A very fine flint here. But now you can see it's white, it's cracked, it's fragmented across the whole site here, and see, you can see the sort of black charring on the outside, but the white, the heat has turned it white in the middle.
And that crazy paving effect on there, sort of microscopic crazy paving effect, that is, they're fire cracks.
Yeah, that's fire cracks, product of heating.
And you can bring it out in one solid lump, can you?
That's what we'd hope to do, and we've been working on this sort of system for the last few years. We've brought small chunks out before, but what we'd like to do now is go back to it with a larger sample. Get a boat with a nice derrick on the back and bring the whole lot up and then excavate it and sample it in slow time in the university.
And it's important to bring it back in one piece like that, because you can then learn more from what the way the stones are placed.
Yep, the orientation of the stones or the sediments in between them, the layering, the patterning, the relationships of all that material tells us so much more. This particular piece of flint in your hand has fallen out of the fireplace. Now it's just one little artifact. The fireplace itself has had so many artifacts within it, and the relationship can tell us a lot about the fire. And we can actually pick out pieces of clay, which are embedded in that fireplace. We can work out the orientation, and we can date it relative to the magnetic field. All sorts of things that we can do once these things are actually part of the landscape. Once they're removed from the landscape and from the archaeological site, they lose a lot of the information.
Might you tell what was being cooked and whether it was burned or not?
Yes, in how well it's been cooked. We should be able to do that. There will be evidence within the fire. There'll be charcoal. There should be evidence, the remains of the material that was being cooked.
What might they have been eating? Salmon?
Salmon, probably. Nice big piece of salmon on that fire. There's quite a lot of use of fish traps in these waterways. Going back, we've got evidence from Denmark. This is the only such site of its kind in the UK. So you're asking questions that we need to examine the sites to find the answers.
But of course, you can only examine the sites to find the answers if you know where the sites are in the first place. So, back in landlocked Birmingham, Vince Gaffney, Simon Fitch and Ken Thompson have been building a virtual landscape of what is now the Southern North Sea. A process so intensive that the supercomputer used to render the images needs a bank of fans constantly whirring to keep it from overheating.
Tilt it down to the right.
Well, if you want to put on the 3D glasses, you can see this is in stereo, and
some extent comes out of the screen.
This is disconcerting. You're actually putting your hand, I can put my hand here, into the North Sea with the water drained away and actually put it into the landscape.
So at the bottom of the picture there's this sinuous feature really through here. It's about 20 kilometres long, maybe a bit longer, before it runs off the edge of the data set. About 600 metres wide. And running off the side of it are smaller sinuous features which connects with it. This one in here. And what we have there is a river system with the tributaries coming into it.
And you can see little oxbow lakes associated with the meandering of that river through the landscape.
You can get some sort of feeling of what it was like to actually live in those days and see this great channel, working its way through the landscape.
So you can use the computer to actually stand on the riverbank at any point, to stand in the river, should you so choose.
Indeed, and it's a very useful feature. You can actually get inside the data and go into it and actually look onto it, but actually be part of it and move into it, which is something that is very, very useful.
And in what way is that useful?
It allows you to gain a sense of perspective of how things fit together, but it also gets, if you're looking for in archaeological terms, obviously you can't deny the human element, and being able to see the landscape, and it gives you a greater understanding of what kind of these people's lives must have been like.
Let me bring Vince in here. Vince, archaeology comes to life in three dimensions. This is something that you wouldn't be able to do without the enormous power of these computers rendering this 3D image for us.
Absolutely. I mean, this landscape is inaccessible. Currently, it only exists in our computers. It's a digital landscape which has been transformed into something we can see, and in fact, on some of our equipment, we can even touch and explore in ways which otherwise would be impossible. If we are going to look at the North Sea, it will be in a virtual form. We'll never be able to do anything other than sample very small areas, even in a perfect world where funding was available. This project's going to recreate an area of about 20,000 square kilometres. That's the largest digital analysis that has ever been performed in archaeological terms.
So as this river snakes away from us here, I can reach out and touch this end. Whereabouts on that river system would you reckon that people might settle, and why?
On one side of the river system, there's what is a relatively amorphous green blob. It's the only way to describe it, I guess. But these, we believe, are shallow basins, which might be either marshes or lakes. If that is the case, and there are very good reasons to believe that to be so, these are areas where human populations would have congregated. There would have been waterfowl there, there'd have been fish, there'd have been eels, the sedge and the reeds around the edges of the lake would be used for matting, creating wicker work and things of that sort, and also in construction as well. Without a doubt, these are optimal areas in human terms. This is where people would want to live.
Can you then go on and prove that they did live here by examining this landscape physically at some stage in the future?
Well, that's the real advance. In the past, what little we knew about this landscape was serendipitous. If something was trawled up, if something came out in a core, well, we have recovered artifacts that way. But we never knew where they came from, what the context was. With this technology, we know where the rivers are, we know where the hills are, we know where the lakes are. We can go within a very small area, say, 10, 20 meters or something like that, and we could put a core into these sediments and retrieve the evidence we want.
Core sampling is more practical, safer and less expensive than diving, especially at depth. And the added advantage is that the North Sea has already been sampled by the British Geological Survey. The cores are stored in a vast shed in Scotland and are being microscopically re-examined in Birmingham for evidence that will help clothe the virtual landscape with flora and fauna.
This is the material from the core from the North Sea that we've been looking at, the one I went and sampled from. the store shed in Edinburgh. As you can see, it's laminated, and it has a slightly peaty look. Can you see any plant remains?
Well, just sorting through a standard low power at around times 15, to be honest, I'm only seeing small bits of planty frost, but I wouldn't be confident to say they're terrestrial.
So there's no seeds at all? Or?
There's no seeds. There's nothing typical of, you know, marsh or anything like that present here.
The existing core samples are widely spaced, sometimes up to a kilometre apart, so it's highly unlikely they'll hit a riverbank or other feature favoured by early humans. But paleoentomologist Dr. David Smith and archaeobotanist Dr. Wendy Smith still have to look.
It's a real minimal chance that the stuff in the core shed is going to be from the channels we're interested in. It'd be nice if it was, but it's a very minimal chance.
But you have to go through
but
that
But we have
process.
To indeed, because, I mean, we are looking potentially down the line at having to ask for very large sums of money, and any way that we could to do that cheaper, faster, better, we'd be wise to pursue. And looking at this material in the core shed would indeed do that.
We actually do have a moment frozen in time, if you like. We have sealed under the North Sea the last vestiges of what that landscape looked like when it was above water.
The key thing to this is getting material that matches the topographic model that's produced by Vince, and being able to date it, and being able to classify whether, for example, the material that is green on Vince's image that we think relates to marsh, whether that really is marsh. And this is where the environmental stuff comes in, because we can do that. We can look for insects that are very typical of marshy environments. We can look for the plant material that's very typical of environments, and also the pollen as well.
Back on the bed of the Solent now with Gary Momba of the Hampshire and White Trust for Maritime Archaeology. The chances of diving in a random fashion onto the seabed and coming across a significant archaeological site are pretty much the same odds as finding a needle in the haystack. What the computer model produced at Birmingham University does is stacks the odds more in favour of the archaeologists so that they know where to dive.
We can only examine a little bit at a time, but I think that the little windows in the past that we can get can give us an idea of that culture, of that environment that those people lived in. So every little piece of information we get is a representative sample of the sort of environment, a climate that these people would have lived in. Of course, the more sites we can get hold of, the more sites we can see and examine, the more we'll really understand about the diversity of these people.
The most important thing to remember when we consider the human populations of the North Sea is that they weren't so different from us. They were as complex as us, they had social structures, they married effectively, I'm sure, they had social relations, and we must never regard them as mindless savages. This would be completely wrong. They had a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, but it was a sophisticated hunter-gatherer lifestyle. They had religious beliefs, we have evidence of that. In some areas we know that at specific periods they buried their dead, particularly in the eastern side of the North Sea. But all the functions that you would equate with the requirements of human life were as important then as they are now.
Phil to Gary.
Phil?
Gary, just tell me what gas you've got left.
80 bar.
Roger, just tell me what gas Rich has got left, please.
I've got 160.
Roger that.
We've dived on one very small patch of ground in the Solent, but you've got the English Channel, the Straits of Dover, up into the southern North Sea, eventually, theoretically, right the way up to the northernmost limit of the landmass, the sort of Shetland and Orkney Hills as they were then.
No, what we're doing is we're doing keyhole surgery. We're just looking at a very small area, and we're trying to identify within that area how rich the resource is. And the more we look within this small area, the more we're finding. What it does, it suggests how much there is. If we're finding this amount in such a small space, there could be so much more out there that we just never knew or believed existed only 10 years ago.
Is it overstating the point to say that current textbooks that preach that there was a bridge between Britain and continental Europe will have to be rewritten?
I think there's no doubt about that. It'll bring into contrast the fact that for much of the Mesolithic, the areas that we live on were peripheral.
One of the things I did do for quite an amusement after I'd first discovered this thing was start going through back at some of the old literature. And I always remember the one book I went through, which had a five-page chapter on the Mesolithic. And its whole idea for the North Sea was one image with a very fuzzy line drawn on. And it said, the North Sea was populated and then it was flooded by rising sea levels. I think we can add a bit more to the story now.
As we make our way to the surface, Gary, professionally, how excited do you get by something like this?
Very. The sites are unique. And the levels of preservation are nothing like those you find on land. You have to remember, the Stone Age is called the Stone Age because most of the remains are stones. But what you can see in front of you, or what you've just seen, and lots of organic remains, they're wood, they're timber with bark on over 8,000 years old. It's going to open up another chapter in our understanding of all the implements that these Stone Age people used. So yes, I think it's incredible, and the potential to really understand our ancestors who weren't that primitive is the evidence would suggest.
We started the programme with the notion that there was a bridge at the bottom of the sea. We've shown that that's nonsense, really, that the textbooks are wrong, that this was more than a bridge.
Yes, it was a large expanse of land that people lived and exploited, and probably lived in a very civilised way. I just hope we can find more. I'm coming to the surface.
Okay, yeah.
The Bridge at the Bottom of the Sea was a Cross Hands production for BBC Radio 4. The presenter was Richard Urich. We've some triumphs and some turkeys.